In the United States, 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. By the time a person reaches 85, the chances of having dementia approach 50%. But life with dementia can be meaningful, argues Dr. Tia Pau, author of the new book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Interweaving medical history and memoir to reveal the untold story of dementia in the U.S., Pau issues a call to action, encouraging readers to shift their focus from cure to care when it comes to treatment. Tia Pau is the director of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Bioethics and again author of the new book, Dementia Reimagined. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Tia Pau to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. Give us an idea of when your work on the subject started, of the reimagining of dementia.
Well, I suppose it starts maybe a decade or more ago. Like as in so many families, dementia is in my family. My mother had dementia and her mother had dementia. And I found that even as a physician, a medical school professor, when it came to having a family member with dementia, I really didn't know what I needed to know to provide good care. And I just felt like I was thinking about dementia all wrong. So I kind of set out to figure out, well, what is wrong with the way I'm thinking about it? What do I need to change? What do I need to learn? And so that's really what led to the book. I think for me, the main point is that for a lot of us, including actually a lot of doctors, when we think about dementia, we think about somebody at the very, very end stage. So somebody maybe who's bedbound, who can't speak, who's incontinent, who can't feed herself. And that's actually true of a very small subset of people with dementia. The vast majority of people with dementia are in the earlier phases. So it might be the person sitting next to you at a family birthday party. It could be the person you see in the grocery store or, you know, heading to a movie theater just in your community and near you. So if we wanted to really think about what it's like to have dementia, what that person or her caregivers might need, we need to kind of change the picture of what we think about when we think about a person with dementia.
One of the things that you make clear in the book is, even as a physician and a bioethicist, this idea of dementia caught you off guard. Your grandmother and then your mother were diagnosed. And not only are you dealing with that, but also this truth that your odds are not great as far as of not getting dementia.
Absolutely. I mean, my odds are not that great. I think it's likely. And unfortunately, that'll be true for a lot of your listeners as well. So as we get older, the single greatest risk factor for dementia is older age. So, and our whole population is aging. By the time any of us gets to be about 85, somewhere between 30 and 50% of us will meet criteria for dementia. It depends on what study you look at and how recently. But dementia, unfortunately, is really, really common, and particularly as we get older. And if you have a family history, that makes it more likely. And, you know, since so many of us now will live to be 85 or more, we didn't used to do that. But now that we do, a lot of us are going to be at risk for dementia. And I absolutely include myself in that number.
The one word that really caught my attention in your subtitle, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End, two words you don't think of, I guess, necessarily, are joy and dignity. But let us begin with dignity, because that's the one that really struck me. How do you start that, as you say, from beginning to end, of making that process of the degradation of the mind a dignified process?
It's a really great question. And I'll say, I know from experience when I talk to people about dementia in the same sentence as joy and dignity, a lot of people roll their eyes and go, this woman clearly doesn't know what she's talking about. But I ask you to bear with me. I do actually know what dementia is. I'm a medical school professor. I'm a doctor. And it's in my family. I've seen it up close, and I've seen it from, you know, the textbook and the intellectual side, too. So bear with me. What I'm saying is we don't think of it that way, and I think we should, because it's going to affect a lot of us. If we're going to live to an old age, a lot of us are going to live with dementia, and I personally like to figure out how to do that better. So that's my sort of game plan. And what would dignity have to do with that? Well, I think there are a lot of ways in which we treat people who have dementia, who have cognitive impairments related to old age, that really undermine their dignity. So here's a delicate question for you. There are a lot of discussions lately, and I think it's appropriate to have those discussions, about the issue of sexuality and dementia. Famously, a few years ago, there was a man who was arrested, an older gentleman who was a state senator in Iowa, who was arrested for having sex with his wife who had dementia. She was in a nursing home. Everybody got all upset, saying, well, she has dementia. She can't possibly give consent. It's just a bizarre way of thinking about it. I mean, these were two people in their 80s. She was always happy to see her husband. No one ever argued that the woman in question with dementia was in some way offended or protested, that this was hurtful or dangerous for her. It's just that we have a notion that consent has to do with intellectual capacity, and I'm not sure that's right in every circumstance. Those of you who have people with dementia in your families, I think, will agree with me when I say just because you have dementia and your thinking isn't as sharp as it used to be, it doesn't mean you don't have opinions. It doesn't mean you don't have preferences and values. And thinking about how we respect the fact that a person with dementia is an adult, has a long history, maybe with this person, how do we shift our notion of, let's get the balance right. We do want to protect people who are vulnerable, but we also want to support the adult choices, the life. We want to recognize that this may somebody be someone who's worked hard for 90 years, all their life. Should we be treating them like children? Should we be treating them, in some cases, almost like prisoners? So let's think about what dementia and dignity together would look like. Sometimes it's a small thing. There are nursing homes that decide that everybody in there has to wake up at the same time every day, which is, frankly, kind of what we do in prisons. And I'm not sure what crime some of these older people with dementia have committed, but if I make it to my 90s and I've worked all these years and raised a family and paid my taxes, I'm not sure that I'm not allowed to sleep in if I feel like it. Seriously, I mean, who better? You know, you're ache, you're tired, why not? So there are nursing homes that have decided, right, it's not a prison. These people are not under our control. Let's figure out, this is where they live. This is their home now because they need some help. But how can we do that in a way that's joyful, that's respectful, that's comfortable? If somebody doesn't feel like getting up, maybe you don't want somebody to simply stay in bed all the time. You know, that's not good for your muscles. It's not good for your energy. But can we be more respectful? Can we grant the dignity of adulthood to people, even when they have dementia, even when they have quite serious cognitive impairments? So that would be a start. You know, can you get on your own schedule? It seems to me you've deserved it if you've gotten to that ripe old age. And are there other things that we can do, too, that respect the dignity of older people with dementia?
And that's a lesson as much for the patient as they go through the process, but also, of course, for the family. Because I think most people would want the best for their loved one, and sometimes maybe that just needs to be explained.
Of course. I think we could do a much better job with education. There are a lot of people who are quite devoted family members, but no one has really bothered to give them a good education of what dementia looks like, what are the ways in which it develops, what are some of the common problems you might expect to see, and how might you, particularly when your loved one still has enough cognitive skill to be able to say, well, I wouldn't like this or I would like that in a particular set of circumstances. I mean, one very controversial issue in severe dementia as we get toward the end stage is feeding tubes. So geriatricians and other experts have been battling for years to explain feeding. Most people with severe dementia have swallowing difficulties. It's more than 90% of people toward the end stage. So what we used to do is say, well, you know, your loved one has difficulty swallowing. You don't want your mom to starve to death, do you? We're going to give her a feeding tube. We're going to punch a hole in her stomach, and we're going to deliver her mushed up food straight to the stomach, and you don't want her to starve, so let's do that. So that's what we used to do for a lot of people 20 or 30 years ago. There is now a wealth of data, an overwhelming amount of data that tells us that a feeding tube for somebody in end-stage dementia does not improve quality of life. It makes quality of life worse, and it doesn't increase quantity of life. It doesn't make you live longer, and it doesn't make you live better. So what the heck, man? Why do we need that? You know, if you put a feeding tube in somebody, you don't really have to move them to the dining room anymore. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to see anybody. Nobody has to sit there and be with them while they eat or help them. And in fact, because a lot of people, they don't know what that tube is doing. It's uncomfortable. They may pull at it. A lot of people get their hands tied down. They get restrained when they have a feeding tube. It's actually a horrible way to spend the last 6 months to a year of your life. I'd much rather, for me, if it comes to me and it's the end of my life, I'd much rather have somebody try and feed me. I won't be able to eat a lot. That's because I have a terminal illness at that point. Nobody with a terminal illness, no matter what it is, cancer, heart disease, nobody eats a huge thumping meal at that stage in a terminal illness. You eat a little bit, I'd like to taste something. That's one of the joys that'll still be there for me. You know, if I can't eat a huge amount, that's kind of okay, because that's what happens when you're at the end stage of a terminal illness. So I think thinking about what medical technology helps us and what really doesn't, what actually makes the death that is coming to that person worse, what makes us have a bad death, because that's some of what we're using medical technology for, and that's not a win. That nobody really wants that. But I think I take this seriously as a physician. I think we've done, in many cases, a pretty crummy idea of explaining to people in earlier phases of dementia so they can get their choices lined up and write them down and tell their family, and explaining to family members of people with really ill relatives, here's some things that you could do. Here's what I think would benefit. But in the big picture, this is where I would go. I would stick with comfort care. I'd think about, what should that last year look like? Do you want to try and keep this person at home? Do you want to try and keep them, you know, out of the hospital, out of the emergency room, which is so miserably uncomfortable, out of the ICU, which is not going to turn their dementia around? So I think we need to do a lot of thinking about, you know, those of us who can do it, let's smart up. Let's think about, you know, how can we get this thing organized a little bit better to give better support to people with dementia and their families.
Tia Powell is our guest. The name of the book is Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. My wife's grandmother had dementia and was in a facility for several years, a long time at the end of her life. And so I spent a lot of hours and days in that facility. One of the things that struck me in just sort of watching what goes on around you is that the staff of this particular facility, anyway, which I would say was excellent, and I had nothing but praise for the care that they gave our family member. But I remember thinking that it just seemed that so much time and so much effort was by the staff was toward the loved ones because they were so distraught of seeing their close relative in this condition, of not being remembered, of not having their name known, of thinking they were somebody else. And so let me ask the bioethicist on this phone call, how do you balance that of giving the care to that individual who's in the bed, who is the one who's being treated, and right, versus the people who come in and out however many times, we don't want to judge, but... And to really, because they seem to want to be more the focus than the person who has the illness.
Right. Joe, I think you've really pulled up something incredibly important here. I think that dementia can be so hard on the people who love the person with dementia. And I think we can do a lot more with education that we have. I think sometimes people take it, you know, they're very hurt when someone doesn't remember them, someone who's so important to them, you know, your mother, your grandmother, your father, your sister. It's terribly heartbreaking. And we need to acknowledge that there is sorrow and that's right and proper, that this is the end of the phase when this person knew you. But that person is still there. And what would you want if you were in their shoes and you could no longer recognize the people around you? What would you want from them? How could you benefit from their presence? Maybe after a certain point, maybe not. Maybe you wouldn't want them to bother to visit if you didn't know them. But I found, you know, toward the end from my mother, I'm not sure that she could always have picked out my name. And I know for, you know, sometimes she mixed up the generations. She would see one of us and she would think my brother was her brother. You know, and it's kind of the same features are repeating. Probably the way she my mother would have remembered her brothers was much more the age consistent with my brothers. You know, that young face and those same eyes from the family, that same hair, that same nose. So it's not an insult. It's not that this person didn't love you or doesn't love you, but they are entering in a different phase. And if you can think about how you can give them support and what support you might want there, I think it's helpful and it's part of the healing process. We have to not only think about the loss of that particular relationship, but just think about how frightening it might be to be in a place where suddenly everyone seemed a stranger. So maybe you can be a friendly stranger. Maybe even though it's your mother, and it's hard, maybe you can be the person, because you know what she loves, maybe you can be the person that still could make her laugh that day. And she may not know it's you, but you'll know that she is herself. If you can get that laugh, if you can play her music that she loved, if you can bake one of her recipes, and it was her favorite, it was her knock-it-out-of-the-park dish, and you can give her a bite of that, I think that approach, which a lot of people, this is not certainly my own, you know, I'm not the only one who's thinking about this, but I think that approach of figuring out what you can still give, how you can still share a moment with that person, could provide a lot of healing to people as they're suffering with the loss of that, you know, real-time, day-to-day, oh, hi, you know, Sally, it's you, I recognize you. You can't have that, but maybe it would be possible to think of what you could have.
As we wrap up our time together, as, again, to the subtitle of From Beginning to End, you mentioned that both your grandmother and your mother had dementia. So how do you find yourself preparing if that is the case, if you are diagnosed?
Well, I can do a couple of things. I think my family is very clear about my wishes around end-of-life care. If I should have dementia or, you know, and or other fatal illnesses, I think they understand the kind of approach I would like. You don't have to focus on every single treatment, although pretty much everybody who knows me knows I don't want a feeding tube if I end up with severe dementia. And my colleagues tease me about that, and my students, actually. So you can take some steps about end-of-life care and really say, if this is what you want, you know, I'd really like the focus to be on palliative care. I'd like to see if every day that remains could be a good day. I'd like to be comfortable. I'd like to see if there's a way in which I could be happy. Could I hear something, look at something, or taste something that would be joyful? And then work back from there. What could I pack with me, in a sense, and bring it along if I should develop dementia? So I love gardening. I love plants. I'm not particularly good at it. I assure you I've killed many more plants than I've kept alive. But that doesn't mean I don't love them. You know, I don't like to keep them around. So I can do pretty vigorous gardening now. But is there a way, you know, wherever I end up living, can there be a community garden? Could there be a way where I could be there and, you know, watch people gardening? Or, you know, could I have, you can give me a bulb and I'll plant it and unplant it all day? You know, could there be some place, could there be a way where I could still enjoy that? Could I be outside? Could I feel the sun on my skin? Could I look at the trees waving in the breeze? I would love that if I could still have that when I don't know the names of the plants anymore. And, you know, I'm not strong enough to dig a hole that with a tree or even a, you know, a pansy would go into. But could I still have some of that joy? So I'd like to think about what could I take with me if I end up in the country of dementia? Are there some things I have now that might age well and might go along with me? And that's a thing I think that we could all do, and it might help us take a little bit less grim and maybe a little bit more, just a ray of hope, bring some little bit of hope into our idea of what dementia is or could be.
Dr. Tia Powell is the author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. The book is published by Avery. Tia, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.